slurped Slurpees. It was a cameo of American Midsummer in the latter half of the 20th century, and for a moment, Billy warmed toward it. Toward them. "All that's lacking is the gypsies," a voice inside him whispered, and the chill came back. A chill real enough to bring goosebumps to his arms, and cause him to abruptly cross his thin arms over his reed of a chest. "We ought to have gypsies, oughtn't we? The old station wagons with the NRA stickers and the rusty bumpers, the campers, the vans with the murals on the sides. Then Samuel with his bowling pins and Gina with her slingshot. And they all came running. They always came running. To see the juggling, to try the slingshot, to hear the future, to get a potion or a lotion, to bet a girl, or at least to dream of it, to see the dogs tear at each other's guts. They always come running. Just for the strangeness of it. Sure, we need the gypsies. We always have. Because if you don't have someone to run out of town once in a while, how are you going to know you yourself belong there? Well, they'll be along soon, right?" "Right," he croaked, and sat down on a bench that was almost in the shade. His legs were suddenly trembling, strengthless. He took an orange out of the bag, and after some effort, managed to tear it open. But now his appetite was gone again, and he could only eat a little. The bench was quite a distance apart from the others, and Billy attracted no undue attention, so far as he could tell. From a distance, he could have been a very thin old man, taking in a little afternoon air. He sat, and as the shade crept up first over his shoes, then his knees, and finally puddled in his lap, an almost fantastical sense of despair overtook him, a feeling of waste and futility much darker than these innocent afternoon shadows. Things had gone too far, and nothing could be taken back. Not even Ginelli, with his psychotic energy, could change what had happened. He could only make things worse. "I should have never," Billy thought, but then, whatever it was he should have never done, broke up and faded out like a bad radio signal. He dozed again. He was in Fairview, a Fairview of the living dead. Corpses lay everywhere, starvelings. Something pecked sharply at his shoulder. No, peck, no. But it came again, peck and peck and peck. It was the vulture with the rotting nose, of course, and he didn't want to turn his head, for fear it might peck his eyes out with the black remnants of its beak. But peck, it insisted, and he, peck, peck, slowly turned his head, rising out of the dream at the same time and seeing, with no real surprise, that it was Tadeusz Lemke beside him on the bench.
"Wake up, white man from town," he said,
and plucked sharply at Billy's sleeve again with his twisted, nicotine-stained fingers. Peck.
"Your dreams are bad. They have a stink I can smell on your breath."
"I'm awake," Billy said thickly.
"You sure?"
Lemke asked with some interest. "Yes." The old man wore a gray serge suit, double-breasted. On his feet were high-topped black shoes. What little hair he had was parted in the middle and pulled sternly backward from his forehead, which was as lined as the leather of his shoes. A gold hoop sparkled from one of his earlobes. The rot, Billy saw, had spread. Dark lines now radiated out from the ruins of his nose and across most of his runneled left cheek.
"Cancer," Lemke said.
His bright black eyes, the eyes of a bird for sure, never left Billy's face.
"You like that? It make you happy?"
"Happy" came out, "happy." "No," Billy said. He was still trying to clean away the dregs of the dream, to hook himself into this reality. "No, of course not."
"Don't lie," Lemke said. "There is no need. It make you happy. Of course it make you happy."
"None of it makes me happy," he said. "I'm sick about it all. Believe me."
"I don't believe nothing no white man from town ever told me,"
Lemke said. He spoke with a hideous sort of geniality.
But you sick, oh yeah, you think. You nastan farsk, dying from being thin. So I brought you something. It's gonna fatten you up, make you better.
His lips drew back from the black stumps of his teeth in a hideous grin.
But only when somebody else eats it.
Billy looked at what Lemke held on his lap and saw with a floating kind of déjà vu that it was a pie in a disposable aluminum pie plate. In his mind, he heard his dream self telling his dream wife, I don't want to be fat. I've decided I like being thin. You eat it.
You look scared, Lemke said. It's too late to be scared, white man from town.
He took a pocket knife from his jacket and opened it, performing the operation with an old man's grave and studied slowness. The blade was shorter than the blade of Ginelli's pocket knife, Billy saw, but it looked sharper. The old man pushed the blade into the crust and then drew it across, creating a slit about 3 inches long. He withdrew the blade. Red droplets fell from it onto the crust. The old man wiped the blade on the sleeve of his jacket, leaving a dark red stain. Then he folded the blade and put the knife away. He hooked his misshapen thumbs over opposing sides of the pie plate and pulled gently. The slit gaped, showing a swimming, viscous fluid in which dark things, strawberries maybe, floated like clots. He relaxed his thumbs. The slit closed. He pulled at the edges of the pie plate again. The slit opened. So he continued to pull and release as he spoke. Billy was unable to look away.
So, you have convinced yourself that it is, what do you call it, a push? That what happened to my Susanna is no more your fault than my fault or her fault or God's fault? You tell yourself you can't be asked to pay for it. There is no blame, you say. It slides off you because your shoulders are broken. No blame, you say. You tell yourself and tell yourself and tell yourself, but there is no push, white man from town. Everybody pays, even for things they didn't do. No push.
Lemke fell reflectively silent for a moment. His thumbs tensed and relaxed, tensed and relaxed. The slit in the pie opened and closed.